Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
What's the big mystery behind the Italian author Domenico Starnone's new novel? Greg Coles will talk to Starnone, his translator, and the novelist Jhumpa Lahiri, who translated his new book, Ties.
One must hear the story in order to write the story. So I heard Ties as I read it to myself in Italian. And when I translated it, my method of translating was to read the book out loud.
How does our oral history, or rather our oral hygiene history, tell a larger story about America? Mary Otto will be here to talk about her new book, Teeth.
We look at bad teeth through sort of a moral lens, like it's a personal failure and an economic failure to have bad oral health.
Alexander Alter will give us an update from the literary world. Plus, we'll talk about what we and the wider world are reading. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul.
This is Greg Coles. I'm an editor with The Book Review. I am very pleased to be here today with the Italian novelist Domenico Starnone. He's the author of the new book, Ties, which has been translated by Jhumpa Lahiri. Jhumpa is also with us today. Jhumpa, hello.
Hello.
And we are also joined by Domenico's English editor, Michael Reynolds of Europa Editions, who will be translating for Domenico. Michael, hi.
Hi.
Domenico, I wonder, how did you come to write this book and how do you see it fitting into your larger career?
I started writing novels about young people, working from my experience as a teacher and in the schools. My novels then moved on to address family experiences that I had experienced directly, firsthand. Ties is a book about family, and it is connected intimately with another book, Via Gemito. It is a story of a marital crisis, and it deals with certain subjects and themes that I have experienced personally and that are very much a part of the milieu that I was a part of growing up.
In her review for us, our reviewer and New York Times reporter Rachel Donadio notes that your earlier books have very overtly embraced metafiction, that you have been very much a part of those books, but that this one avoids that on the surface anyway. So I wanted to ask if that was a conscious decision on your part to avoid metafiction here.
As far as I'm concerned, what's generally considered to be metafiction, I consider to be a normal part of the structure of fiction, the structure of storytelling. This process is more or less visible depending on the story and the intention that the author has. In the case of Ties, the process or the entering of the author is less visible. Ties is organized into three autonomous blocks. They are, in a certain sense, small stories, self-contained stories. Obviously, they interact with one another in the broader, more complex structure of the novel. But they are, for all intents and purposes, each of them is a novella. So this book doesn't follow, I suppose, what is the normal flow of the metafiction that I've created in the past, but the author is still present there in the structuring of this story.
That's great. Let's talk about the story then and the structure. It is, as you say, in three parts. Part one gives the wife's perspective, Vanda's point of view, through a series of letters. And then we shift in part two to Aldo's perspective. Then in part three, we get their children, the children's experience of their parents' marriage. It's Anna and Sandro. Domenico, I wonder how you came to that structure. It's different, as I understand it, from what your previous books have been.
The structure has been designed to suggest to readers that each of these existences are closed existences, the existence of Wanda, she is closed within herself, and the same is true of Aldo and the children. And when these closed existences bump up against one another, as they do in the novel, thanks to this structure, there's a risk of each of them breaking or breaking down.
You said that Ties is in some ways revisiting or in conversation with your earlier novel, Via Gemino. When it came out in Italy in 2014, a number of people have pointed out that it also seems to be in close conversation with the Elena Ferrante novel, The Days of Abandonment. Rachel says in the review that there are other correspondences between your work and hers. And in that light, forgive me, I should mention the article that appeared last fall contending that Ferrante is in fact your wife, Anita Raya. So let me just ask outright, is it true that Elena Ferrante is Anita Raya?
È vero che Anita Raya è Elena Ferrante?
È una questione che non ho nessuna intenzione di affrontare. Tendo invece, voglio assolutamente sottolineare che io non sono Elena Ferrante. Per il resto, se le capita l'occasione, chiederà a mia moglie.
Ok. I have no intention of addressing that question, but I will take this opportunity to underline the fact that I am not Elena Ferrante, and I hope that one day you'll have the chance to ask my wife that same question.
Ferrante has, of course, guarded her privacy very closely, so many readers, and I am one, saw last fall's article as a violation. Here in America, anyway, some even saw it as an act of violence. And I wonder what you make of that.
I dislike greatly, I have great disregard for this kind of journalism when it is applied to literature. Literature is a very complex thing. And the kind of journalism that was exhibited in that article was simplistic. And I have no further comment.
That said, is Rachel right that Ties, the novel, is responding in some way to the novel The Days of Abandonment?
Absolutely not. Ties is a book about abandonment, about who abandons and who is abandoned. And as such, it fits into a very rich literary tradition. And that, of course, doesn't exclude the idea that there are points of contact between The Days of Abandonment and Ties. Books have points of contact that run between them. They rub up against each other. They are made and remade. Anna Karenina and Madame Bovary have many, many similarities. At the same time, they're completely autonomous books, and the results of each book for the reader are different.
Hai trascurato di dire che c'è un abisso tra Anna Karenina e Madame Bovary e i due libri di cui stiamo parlando.
And I want to be clear that there's there's an abyss between Anna Karenina and Madame Bovary and the two books that we've been talking about.
I wanted to bring Jhumpa Lahiri into the conversation and talk a bit about translating this book. Jhumpa, you effectively renounced English for a number of years, living in Rome, embracing Italian. Your own most recent book, in other words, was written in Italian about that experience. And you say in your introduction to Ties that translating this novel was your re-entry into English. So I wonder, first, if you could just explain quickly how that came about, and then second, talk a little bit about how the experience of translating it changed your own relationship to English again.
Well, I was asked by the author, which is a remarkable thing in and of itself. I had a sort of instantaneous desire to translate Ties as soon as I read it in Italian, a desire that was an element of chaos in a certain order I was following, this very orderly pursuit of Italian, living in Rome, not reading in English anymore, thinking and writing in Italian, and yet Ties came to me in Italian and awakened, sort of upset this orderly pattern I was establishing. And this is the importance of chaos, after all, right? This is the importance of these elements that disrupt the order and change the game. So this novel changed the game I was playing. And I'm so glad it did, in that it has created a new equilibrium for me creatively and linguistically now that I find myself back in the United States, surrounded not by Italian, but by English predominantly, and gives me the right balance, I think, when I'm in the United States, to feel both constantly tied, literally, to the Italian language in the process of translating, and also to be moving now back and forth, or to be existing sort of in this space between the languages, right? I think that's what the translator does. I don't think it's a clear-cut activity of transporting one language from one room into another room, because that's not, it's so much more complex what happens in the actual thinking out of the translation.
Has translating changed your own relationship to English?
Well, it's changed the relationship in that part of my brain has now been reawakened. You can assess what's going on in my brain from what dictionaries are on my desk at any given time. So in Rome, there were multiple Italian dictionaries at all times that I was constantly consulting and sort of sleeping with and waking up with and getting up in the middle of the night to look things up. You know, at a certain point, I wasn't even using the Italian-English dictionaries. You know, I was just using the monolingual dictionaries. Now, in order to translate, I have to not only go back to the Italian-English dictionaries as well as the monolingual, but also my English dictionaries and my English thesaurus. And so the content of the dictionaries represents sort of where I am, I think. And I think, of course, one must mention that it is a dictionary. We have a dictionary at the heart of this novel playing a very interesting role, which I will not reveal to the listeners because it's too extraordinary, you know, to give away. But, you know, words as agents of chaos, language, the way that language can introduce and upset the order, the perceived order, the understood order, the order on the surface of things. This is a very complex novel, and I think it's complex on the level of language, above and beyond everything else, the plot, the idea of family, containers, yes, but then it's what it's really looking at is, I think, is language. And so I think for a writer, for anybody, for any of us, I hope, it's a novel that bears endless contemplation.
In your own writing, you are a very fluid and musical writer of English. And so it's maybe no surprise that this book reads beautifully in English, but translating is not writing. And I wonder how hard it was for you to translate from the Italian into this beautiful English that we have.
I think translation is writing. And what I'm doing is writing. I'm not creating the story. I'm not inventing and building the characters. I'm not giving them, I'm not putting meat on their bones. I'm not moving them around. I'm not deciding what they say. But I am writing when I'm translating. You know, I'm writing with a different set of constants, right? I mean, we can't write without constants, because otherwise we're in the realm of chaos. And writing is a way of ordering. Writing has always been a way for people to order the inherent chaos of life. And language gives us those instruments, those means to order life, to contain it literally in a sentence, in a paragraph, in a bound volume, whatever, you know, however you want to look at it. But I think what happens in the act of translation is really quite wild and chaotic, because the writer writes something that remains contained in the original language, right? Unless Domenico wants to go back, and I know as a writer there are moments where I think, oh, well, if I had the chance, if someone gave me that book I wrote 10 years ago, yes, I would change 90% of it practically, but I won't because it's destructive, right? And the idea is to move forward and make new work. But when I translate, there is such fluidity There are so many options. There are so many shadings. There are so many variations. And this is why not only could I be capable of translating ties in a dozen different ways, given a dozen different days, right? But others will be able to retranslate this book into English if they should so wish, if they should feel the need in time to do so, to revisit the book. So I think the wonderful thing about translation is that it is this sort of healthy form of literary chaos, you know, because you're undermining and you're digging up and you're reinvigorating a pre-existing text. This is a very exciting thing to think about, right, for me.
You fell in love with this novel in the original Italian. In some ways, this is a question for all of translation, but is it as successful a novel in English, do you think, or is it in some ways just an approximation of the original?
Well, that's not for me to answer. I've done my best to give the book life in English. I believe that my translation is my homage to this book as a reader. The one thing I really took away from my experience of studying creative writing, and this was from my great teacher, Leslie Epstein, he told us distinctly one day, one must hear the story in order to write the story. So I heard Ties as I read it to myself in Italian. And when I translated it, my method of translating was to read the book out loud. One word in Italian can yield far too many possibilities in any given language. And this is the reality of the translator's task. But I think once you begin to hear the book in the other language, then there's a certain tonality that begins to create order for the translator. And there's a certain range of vocabulary. And the more I heard Domenico's Italian and his tendencies, the words he would gravitate toward, that allowed me to channel a similar dimension, shall we say, in English. And I think it's this double hearing, right, that is necessary for me in any case. I mean, I will say it was slow to start, partly because Wanda's point of view with which the book opens is the most challenging part of the book and was the most challenging part of the book for me as a translator because the voice is so intense and she's in an extreme state, right? She's both in a rage and she's coldly calculating on some level. And that's tricky. That's tricky to write, but it's even trickier, I think, to try to replicate in translation. I think once I reached Aldo's section, I was inherently more in tune with his voice. And so it came more easily to me. But of course, the other thing is, because, as you say, this translation represents my reentry into English, and because there was such enormous resistance on my part, I didn't want to interrupt the way that I had organized my life. I wouldn't call this book a return to English, but it's certainly a re-engagement with English in different terms, because I too am changed.
I don't speak or read Italian, although after today I wish I did very much. But I do read English, and you know, I think it's a terrific book. So Giunpa, thank you. Domenico, thank you. Michael, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This podcast is supported by the Shalom Hartman Institute. For decades, the Shalom Hartman Institute has been the preeminent destination for Jewish ideas and learning. The weekly Identity Crisis podcast with host Yehuda Kurtzer creates better conversations around issues facing contemporary Jewish life. For Heaven's Sake, the award-winning number one Judaism podcast with Daniil Hartman and Yossi Klein Halevi features thoughtful discussions on political and social trends in Israel and Israel-diaspora relations. Discover these chart-topping podcasts at shalomhartman.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Mary Otto joins us now. She is the oral healthcare leader for the Association of Healthcare Journalists, and she has a new book called Teeth: The Story of Beauty, Inequality, and the Struggle for Oral Health in America. Mary, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, I'm so grateful to be here.
Okay, I have to ask you, first of all, how do you become an expert in oral health journalism?
Sometimes I think about Alice falling through the rabbit hole. It was a really sad start to this specialty for me. I was working at the Washington Post covering social issues, and I found myself standing by the hospital bed of this child who was dying of complications from untreated tooth decay about 10 years ago. His name was Diamante Driver, and he was a poor Medicaid child, and his mother had actually been looking for a dentist for his brother when he got sick with this infection, and doctors told her that the bacteria from the abscess tooth had spread to his brain, and he ended up dying of this infection. And it left me wondering, I needed to find out more about the system, and embarked on this journey. I was lucky enough to spend a year at Harvard at the dental school and the School of Public Health as a night science journalism fellow, and that really helped me have the time I needed to grow more fluent in understanding this world.
And you took that social issues background as a journalist for the Washington Post and sort of applied it to this area of oral hygiene. It turns out that there are a lot of social and economic aspects to the story of oral hygiene in America, unexpectedly. Even just going back to that story of Diamante Driver, how does the fact that he was a poor child on Medicaid, how did that affect his oral health care?
Well, I came to realize that as a Medicaid beneficiary, he was one of, you know, millions of children who weren't getting routine dental services that might have prevented his problems in the first place. Fewer than half of Medicaid children get routine dental attention, and fewer than half of our country's dentists participate in the program. So there's a shortage of places they can go for care. Of course, poor families have difficulties paying out of pocket for care. And there are thousands of communities across the country that are federally designated as dental provider shortage areas. So if you're living in a rural place or in a poor urban place, you may have a difficulty getting access that way. Roughly a third of our country faces significant barriers getting routine dental care.
One of the most terrifying or really upsetting aspects of Diamante's story was that his mother had tried to get him coverage, and that one of the dentists who actually was treating his brother, Deshaun, said that that dentist discontinued treatments because Deshaun squirmed too much in the dental chair.
Yeah. There's a shortage, real severe shortage of pediatric dental providers, you know, people who feel comfortable taking care of children. And that was her last option. When she ended up searching for another dentist for Deshaun, she came up against a terrible problem finding one. And she knew a lawyer who was helping poor and homeless families around the area with different problems they were having, mostly with school enrollment. But she's saying, I'm having a terrible time finding a dentist for one of my children. And she enlisted this attorney, you know, and even the attorney and her staff had trouble finding care for Mrs. Driver's child. And in the meantime, Diamante got sick and ended up dying.
Let's talk about how we got here a little bit and go back. You write about the history of American dentistry in this country. Can you take us back to the sort of origins of oral care and how we got to this place?
I was really surprised to find out that the story, the creation story of our American dental profession, had its beginning very close to where Diamante's family lived and where Diamante died. it's remembered now as the piece of our dental history. And the founders of this, the world's first dental college, approached the physicians at the medical school at the University of Maryland and asked if they would be interested in adding a course of dental instruction. And the physicians reputedly said that the subject of dentistry was of no interest to them, and sent the two dentists on their way. And they started the world's first dental college in Baltimore. That event was called the Historic Rebuff, and it's still kind of used as a way of explaining and even defending the separate dental system we have. And it's become not only an educational system, a different system of providing care, different system of paying for care. And it's a gap that a lot of people have a hard time negotiating, the gap between the healthcare system and the oral healthcare system.
Isn't there in Baltimore now a museum of like American dentistry that has George Washington's a set of his wooden teeth?
I don't know if those dentures are still there, but yes, that there is a museum there, and it is kind of a monument to the first dental college in the world, and actually where Mrs. Driver ended up taking Diamante's brother ultimately for the care he needed. Months after Diamante died, he finally found it there at the world's first dental college. They had to take a taxi because she didn't have a car, and the fare cost about $80, and they crossed that historic gap.
How do other countries handle dental care versus other forms of health care? Are they routinely separated?
In some places they are, and I would love to explore that. It's a little bit beyond the expanse of this book, but I just talked to someone in Australia the other day who said their system is the same way. You know, there's this sort of disjoint. And it may date back to the days when dentistry was really considered a trade, and then sort of evolved as a sort of a branch of surgery, which it still is in some ways treated. It's not looked at as a like other health problems, like a chronic, you know, complex infection that tooth decay is.
So in terms of dental care for the poor and for the elderly, Medicaid covers it, but sporadically. What about Medicare?
Medicare's never covered routine dental care. So that leaves, you know, more than 50 million Americans who are covered by Medicare don't get dental coverage under their routine Medicare benefits. They either have to go out and buy or find additional benefits, but many, many Medicare beneficiaries do not have dental coverage.
How many Americans do have dental coverage?
Over 100 million have coverage through private benefits. Another more than 50 million have public benefits of some kind or another. I've heard the estimate of about 114 million have no coverage of any kind.
It seems like this is a case where you really see economic inequality in this country play out. On the one hand, emergency dental health care for the poor, and on the other end, very high-end preventative care for the wealthy, and dental care as a form of beautification.
Yeah, you're right. That's very true. There's that Hollywood smile, the American smile, is kind of a status symbol around the world. And people opt for these veneers. You know, they call it the front six teeth, the social six. And, you know, that this social six sparkly white teeth are, you know, kind of a badge of success. And yet, on the other hand, a third of low-income Americans avoid smiling, according to this poll that was conducted by the American Dental Association a couple years ago. There's so much shame that people feel about having missing teeth. And we look at bad teeth through sort of a moral lens, like it's a personal failure and an economic failure to have bad oral health.
What about the sort of professional associations in the dental industry? Do they want the system to remain largely privatized?
Yeah, the organized dentistry represents the interests of private practitioners who represent the main source of dental care in this country. And they, over many years, at critical moments, have fiercely defended the private practice system and the marketplace for their services and the fee-for-service kind of model that we have.
To what extent did the Affordable Care Act under President Obama improve or address this situation?
It included children's dental benefits among the essential health care benefits that were required under the state marketplaces for insurance. And through Medicaid expansion, it expanded dental benefits to millions of children. Medicaid considers, at least at this point, dental benefits as an entitlement to children. It leaves dental benefits for adults optional to the state. So some states cover some dental benefits for adults, some don't cover any. In some states, they're kind of scant. And they're, since they're optional, they're vulnerable to cuts, and they often end up on the state budget chopping block in times of fiscal austerity when, you know, people need them the most. But in that way, oral health is another kind of economic indicator.
These are obviously uncertain times for healthcare in this country, given the repeal and the imminent form of healthcare under President Trump. Do we have any sense from what we know to date about the implications for dental healthcare?
Well, I've been listening really closely, you know, for mention of oral health and dental benefits as this debate goes on. There's a lot of concern. It's hard to know exactly what's going to happen, but some oral health advocates are very concerned about the block grant issue in state programs. You know, will that reduce funding? Could it eliminate the entitlement to dental benefits that children now have under Medicaid? If history's any indication, you know, dental benefits get kind of sidelined from other kinds of health care benefits. And of course, you know, as everything's being weighed and reconsidered, there's always a concern that that could happen again.
Final question. Obviously, the story of Diamante Driver dying from lack of access to good dental health care is a terrifying one. But how important is oral health care to overall health? How risky is it not to have your teeth regularly seen by a dentist?
I mean, it's really important. And preventive care is, you know, so much more useful than we sometimes remember. Just getting children, very small children, in for a baby checkup. Even a lot of medical providers and nurses and physicians now who are far more likely to see little children than dentists are learning and actually being able to bill Medicaid and other programs for oral exams and preventive fluoride treatments on first baby teeth. It's important to integrate these oral health messages into our healthcare system and bring it into the conversation in all kinds of ways.
All right. Well, there's lots of gruesome early and current oral health care sort of drama in this book, but also a lot of really important social science and journalism as well around the current state of oral health care in this country. Mary, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mary Otto is the author of Teeth, The Story of Beauty, Inequality, and the Struggle for Oral Health in America. Alexander Alter joins us now with news from the literary world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
What's going on this week?
So this week, the Association of American Publishers released their latest report. They track sales from 1,200 publishers, so it's pretty extensive. And their numbers reflected what everyone thought was happening last fall. They released the numbers from October of last year. They were not good. As publishers and writers and publicists across the industry kept saying, nobody was buying books. Everybody was glued to the news. Everyone was obsessed with the election, and it was impossible to get authors on TV. Bookstores were complaining about this as well. So now the numbers show that sales of adult trade books fell 13% in October of 2016.
It's
compared
really
to the
no
previous
surprise,
year.
Right?
It was not a big surprise, but that was, you know, hardcover suffered the most. It fell 24%. And, you know, this is leading into the the holiday season, and the fall is usually the season for the biggest literary releases for both fiction and then also big nonfiction. So, you know, it did put a dent in the industry overall. They also released their sales figures for different formats, and those trends have continued. As we've seen before, downloaded audio continues to be the most popular format. When they were looking at January through October, it grew 27%. So that's huge. I mean, that's, you know, kind of like where ebooks used to be. Ebooks were down still, again, 17%, so slightly smaller decline, but still dropping. And hardback books were fine. They were sort of flat. Paperback was growing. That grew 6.8%.
Nice.
So it's interesting.
I'm going to cling to the good news, Alexandra.
Yes, it seems like people are kind of reading in print and listening, and maybe the listening part is taking up the space on their devices where they used to be reading ebooks, possibly. So that pretty much confirmed people's worst fears of last fall, but, you know, now we're back to, I suppose, a more politically normal period? No, we're not.
It's not. It's not. But it's springtime.
It's springtime. It's time to sit on, like, grassy hills
exactly. And open your books.
And there's already, as we've talked about on this podcast before, a big kind of crop of books about the election. So now people can buy books about it instead of just obsessing about the news. And that was sort of a snapshot of what's going on in this country in the publishing world. And there's some interesting things happening overseas as well. This week, Publishers Weekly put out a little report about some of the books overseas that are selling well and picking up a lot of foreign attention, foreign deals. The London Book Fair just concluded, so we're seeing what's resonating, and I'm sure some of these will be coming to the U.S. at some point. One is a Colombian author, Melba Escobar. Her novel is called The Beauty House, and it was recently acquired by HarperCollins in the U.K., at the London Book Fair, and it's been selling well in Latin America and other parts of Europe, France, Italy. It's about a beautician in Bogota who becomes a witness in the investigation of a murder of one of her clients. So that sounds kind of interesting. Another novel that was doing well at the London Book Fair is My Enemy's Cherry Tree by Wang Ting-kyo. This is a Taiwanese author, and the World English Rights sold in the UK to Portobello. This is about the long kind of entangled history of two men, a cafe owner and the man who was his mentor previously. And finally, another thriller. This is from Sweden. It's called In the Mire by Suzanne Jensen, and that sold in several territories. So this book is about a woman named Natalie who is a biologist, and she's traveling in rural Sweden. She's conducting experiments in this mire, and she discovers a dead body.
Do we have a sense of when American readers will be able to get their hands on these books in U.S. editions?
Not yet. You know what's interesting about American publishers is they often wait for the U.K. sales to sort of spike. Unless there's really a ton of interest in an international title, they'll watch translations kind of unfold in the U.K. We saw that with Han Kang's The Vegetarian and other books like that. That was a novel that came out of South Korea last year and ended up winning the Man Booker International Prize and sold quite well here. So American publishers tend to wait for their UK counterparts to kind of take the risk and do the translations. That's not always the case. Sometimes they'll jump in earlier, but I think we'll see how these books do in the UK, and then some US publishers will probably start to bite.
So that's like our 2018, 2019, 2020
preview
from Alexandra. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
My colleagues John Williams, Parul Sehgal, and special guest Jenny Schuessler join us now to talk about what we're reading. Hey, guys.
Hey, Pamela. Hey.
All right, let's start with John.
First, on a quick note, I've been rereading Dennis Johnson's Jesus's Son, a very slender but very potent collection of short stories from 1992, because it's celebrating its 25th anniversary. So I went to an event earlier this week where...
It's such a weird book to like have a celebration.
Well, I told the friend who I took with me, I said, how could you live anywhere but New York where they reserve a giant room like this to celebrate a short story collection from the early 90s? It just seems impossible.
Is there anything like that's that more influential? Like when I was in the MFA program, Every woman was trying to write like Didion, it felt like, or Laurie Moore, and all the guys were trying to rewrite.
Well, Michael Cunningham was one of the people on the panel Monday night, and he said that, you know, he tried to imitate Ray Carver when he first started out, and then when he was teaching, he said, oh, here come all the Dennis Johnson imitators. And it's really
almost nothing worse than
that. And when I interviewed Elizabeth McCracken a couple of years ago for a profile I was writing of someone, she said that she thinks it's the most beloved book of short stories by any writer in the last 20, 25 years among other writers that she knows. So that's been really fun because it's a great book, and it's quick to get through. In addition to that. And then I've been reading just a random pick off my shelf, which is a memoir from the early 80s by a woman named Eileen Simpson, and it's called Poets in Their Youth. And she married John Berryman, the poet, in the 40s, in the early 40s. And through him, became friendly with Robert Lowell and Jean Stafford and other people. And you have to obviously sort of be interested in like mid-century American literary life because it's not action-packed, but it gives you really close-up views, obviously, of Berryman and Lowell and other people, and she's a really good writer. You sometimes forget that it's a memoir. You start thinking it's a biography of one of these people, and then you think, oh, why isn't she mentioning, you know, what his grandparents did? And then you go, oh, right, this is just a very personal take. So it's very elegantly done. What that really did, though, was it sent me back to one of my favorite books of all time, which is Wilfred Sheed's essay collection, Essays in Disguise, because he has a review of Simpson's book. It's actually the way I first heard of it. And he also has a profile of Jean Stafford, which is fantastic. But just to give you a sense of Sheed's greatness, so he's writing about poets in their youth, and he's writing about Berryman and Delmore Schwartz, who was another poet-writer who was part of this group. He says, I have never seen or joined in such drinking as the lit set could contrive in those days. So what would have seemed like a personal drinking problem elsewhere was lost in the crowd, and Berryman drifted into alcoholism without noticing. He and Schwartz had once talked with contempt of writers who drown their talent in booze, but both would now proceed to do so themselves, having badly misjudged the undertow. So anyway, Wilfred Sheed is the best ever. Parle, what are you reading?
I'm actually reading poetry this week. I mean, I really drifted. I sort of filed a few pieces earlier in the week and then just couldn't find anything that was sort of keeping my attention. I clearly have a small child because my books are very, very small and I can read them with one hand and sort of like put them in a coat pocket or diaper bag. And I went back and I started rereading Frank Bedard. Have you guys read Frank Bedard?
No, I haven't.
No. Mm-hmm.
Oh, he's so good. They're pretty short poems and they're just full of lust and shame. What is better? And dogs. Lust, shame, and dogs. So all my favorite things. And I hadn't read them in a really long time, and I'd forgotten how erudite he is, how he can just bring in the Greeks, he brings in old Hollywood, he brings in everything, but it always feels so personal, and they really do feel like poems written to his teenage self. It's always with the first discovery of desire, the first discovery of what it's like to pull away from his parents, to find a body, get into trouble.
Was he a contemporary of Lowell's, but he's still around or something?
You know, I don't know much about him. Okay. I think he's very much influenced by Lowell, it feels to me, at least. And you can feel like some of O'Hara coursing through him, but he really does feel very much his own animal. I just want to read a little bit just to give you a sense of like the kind of a doom in his poetry, which I think is just really, I love it. So this is a poem. I'm just going to read a little bit around this poem. It's called On This Earth Where No Secure Foothold Is. Wanting to be a movie star like Dean Stockwell or Gigi Perreau, answering an ad at 10 or 11, you made your mother drive you to Hollywood and had expensive Hollywood pictures taken. Hollywood wasn't buying. Everyone is buying, but not everyone wants to buy you. You see the kids watching, brooding. Religion, politics, love, work, sex, each enthrallment, each enthusiasm presenting itself as a pleasure or necessity is recruitment. Each kid is at the edge of a sea. What do you want to be swallowed by? It's almost the same question as to be or not to be. Figuring out who they want to be bought by is what all the kids with brooding looks on their faces are brooding about. Your weapon is your mind. So, yeah, Frank Bedard. Highly recommend.
You can probably read poetry on every podcast.
Jenny, what are you reading?
I always feel so outclassed when I'm with you guys because I'm only maybe reading
one book at a time. Don't worry, I'm coming
after
you.
But Jenny, this is by design. So
it's a Garfield collection.
Well, I want to just mention a book that I actually wrote about today, which I think is a great book, even though I finished reading it, you know, more than 2 weeks ago, called Word by Word by Corey Stamper, who's a lexicographer at Merriam-Webster Dictionary. Mm-hmm. It's a really fantastic, funny book.
And great story in the paper, too.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. And it will appeal strongly to word nerds, not that any of those people listen to this podcast.
Or are sitting at this table.
And then on a more serious note, I've been reading, finally getting around to reading Robert Worth, our former colleague known around here as Bobby Worth's fantastic book, or so far fantastic book, published last year called A Rage for Order about the Middle East. And it kind of just distills down in this beautiful way, you know, the extensive reporting he did over 10 years in Yemen, Syria, mm-hmm. Egypt, Libya. And it's fantastic. And I'm looking forward to getting back to it. But then I was sort of waylaid on Friday, as tends to happen to me, when I had to really quickly write this story about a shocking development in the literary world, the revelation that Jane Austen has some alt-right readers. So I wrote a story about this. A lot of people on Twitter seem to feel personally trolled by the existence of this story and this headline in this news. Like, not our Jane! But,
yes,
you know,
Jane.
I was sort of curious about the sort of Jane Austen in politics and the history of how she's sort of been enlisted politically or classified politically, whatever. And there's actually a lot of really great scholarship on this, a lot of great scholarship on Jane in general. And I had picked up a book coming out this summer by this a professor at University of Arizona or Arizona State named Devoni Lucer. For fans of the roller derby, you might know her as Stone Cold Jane Austen, her gnome de skate. But anyway, she's written this fascinating, in my opinion, book called The Making of Jane Austen, which really traces kind of the history of her reception. And I've read a lot about the history of Austen, and there's just a lot of fascinating stuff in here she dug up, including the use of Jane Austen symbolism at sort of suffragist marches around the turn of the century. Interestingly, I think we tend to think of her as a writer that has sort of been, rescued from oblivion by women readers, by feminists. Not really true. For a long time, she was considered a very male-oriented writer, had many male fans, Rudyard Kipling. There were these fascinating debates in elite London men's clubs around the turn of the century about Austen. And weirdly, the controversial position was saying you didn't really like Austen. So it sort of turns on our head our sort of notions of the gender politics of Austen. But the most fascinating thing that came up in a chapter with the very alluring title, The First Jane Austen Dissertation. And it is about a
Jenny
man.
Flipped to it first.
I was like, oh my God, dissertation, the magic word. It's about a man named William Henry George Plew, who was a literary scholar and a Harvard Law student in the late, I think, the 1870s, 1890s. And he wrote the first sort of dissertation, meaning lengthy sort of scholarly essay about Jane Austen. And he also he died young, and then he got kind of caught up in this spiritualist movement. So he was contacted from beyond the grave by some of these people kind of in Boston around Harvard, including Charles Eliot Norton, the great literary scholar who was skeptical but was involved in this effort to contact him. And he was sort of conversing about Jane Austen from beyond the grave. It's really crazy. But I just want to read one in the grand tradition of people on this podcast reading things out loud. I want to read a great little sentence from the wind-up to this chapter. It is an odd fact of literary history, perhaps not a truth universally acknowledged, that the first published full-length study of Austen that came out of a school setting and her first young student scholar led to the author making an appearance in paranormal history. In recent years, scholars have written eloquently about Jane Austen's being imagined as a ghost and what that might mean to her celebrity and legacy. But we tend to forget how tightly the scholarly and the pop culture paranormal, like the scholarly and pop education Austen, were once intertwined.
What about the chapter on the Breitbart connection?
That is being written.
Okay. Pamela, you have a couple of things open in front of you.
Well, I finished on the train this morning Candace Millard's The Destiny of the Republic. So this will be the last installment of the podcast where I talk about this. And I cried. I cried on the train. It was incredibly moving. Everyone knows that I have already become a James Garfield convert and think that had he been president for longer than a few months, he may have done great things. I want like the alternate history where he's not shot. But it was really interesting, the epilogue this morning, to think about just the implications of his death and all of the figures that played into this book. Charles Guiteau was the man who assassinated him, and he was clearly insane. And there was a lot of controversy about whether he would plead insanity. Interestingly, this week in New York Magazine, there's a really great story by Lisa Miller about John Hinckley and the controversy over his plea for insanity. So it was interesting to see the parallels. Guiteau was obviously insane. And he was insane in a kind of unsympathetic way, I have to say. You really end up feeling very little for him. He was a narcissist, a fantasist, with these grandiose ideas. He expected people to come and to thank him for having killed Garfield, and wrote a memoir and was expecting it to become a massive bestseller in the wake of the murder. His family had likewise sort of distanced themselves from him, but when he was found guilty and sentenced to death, family members tried to get in touch with his widow, Lucretia, and her children. And this is one of the things that was so moving in the epilogue. His daughter, Molly, said when she found out that Guiteau's sister, Frances, tried to come and sort of seek forgiveness from Lucretia, Garfield's widow, and she learned who the visitor was. Lucretia actually turned Frances away and wouldn't see her. She said, "For her father's assassin, Molly would write bitterly in her diary, 'Nothing could be too awful, and my heart is like stone toward him,'" underlined. This is one of those books where you read the epilogue and you want to read biographies of all the other figures who played into the book. Alexander Graham Bell, Joseph Lister. There actually is a book about Joseph Lister. Listerine is named after him. He was the one who created sort of antiseptic surgery. And you want to just go and sort of read all about them.
The assassin sounds, it sounds like there could be a book about it. There,
oh,
maybe there is.
There has to be a book about him. But I think one of the most moving facts that I learned in this book is that Robert Todd Lincoln, Lincoln's surviving son, was present at three of the four assassinations, presidential assassinations, standing by their side.
God.
Yeah.
Wow.
So
don't
not
stand
only,
next to him.
Yeah. Right. Not only was
amazing.
He there, obviously, for Lincoln, but for Garfield, and then later on for McKinley.
Wow.
I mean, just imagine.
That's incredible.
Yeah. So I will leave you with that.
That's a novel.
Yeah. Yes. You can write it, Jenny. Thanks.
Thanks,
guys.
Pamela.
Thanks.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Inside the New York Times Book Review is produced by Pedro Rosado. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.